right?
This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is March 15th, 2010. This is the second session with Ann Peckham discussing the life and career of Ben Peckham. And we wanted to pick it up today with the fundamental question, which I think you touched on, but I think we ought to address it again. Why Ben chose to become an academic physician rather than staying in private practice, where he could have made presumably a lot more money?
I don't think he ever considered that an option. Northwestern works at a little different, it did at that time. Now we're talking about 1950 when Ben finished his residency. Mm-hmm. Most of the people that taught at Northwestern also had private practice. Mm-hmm. They weren't paid by the university. There was no university staffing. That came along a little bit later. Mm. They started paying the department chairman, which I don't think they had paid before.
Oh.
This was sort of honorary sort of thing. Must have saved them a lot of money.
Sure.
But when he came back and went into residency, he had to mark time for 2 years. So before he could get into the clinical program, and I think I mentioned that, but I'm not sure. But anyway, what he did was he went into the physiology department in the medical school, worked with a man by the name of Dr. Ronald Green, who had also been in the Navy and was back sort of getting started again. And they did, Ronnie Green sort of guided Ben's research. He also started teaching at that time. If you look at his CV, he was an instructor very shortly after, and he found he loved to teach.
Oh, in physiology.
In physiology, right. And
now, Anne, let me interrupt and ask you, was he a natural-born teacher then? Did it come easily to him?
Oh, I think so. I think so. He didn't take any classes on how to teach. I imagine he'd been a good student, so he probably was watching the people that were teaching him all the way along. And he didn't take any special courses in how to teach. I think he just liked to do it.
And he wasn't apprehensive about going into the class. He didn't worry about it.
Not that I know of. Uh-huh. He did prepare.
Extensively?
These are hard questions to ask. They happened a long time ago, and I had my hands pretty full.
Oh, yeah, you had a baby.
I had three babies, and I think he worked every night at home. When he was getting his master's in physiology, he was also working on his PhD. And he published 26 papers by the time he finished at Northwestern in 1956 when he came up here. So he was busy doing that sort of thing, and he did it. He came home and he worked every night. Now, we lived with my parents for a while, and my father was just sort of amazed by this man who worked all day, came home, ate his supper, and sat down at his desk. And so he was, I think a lot of those men that came back from the service at that time, they were so determined that they were going to catch up. Mm-hmm. And they were seeing what was happening with their fellows who had not gone in the service, and how the life, you know, how much they had accomplished and how much money they were making and all that sort of thing. It wasn't all money, but it was accomplishment. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of determination at that particular, you know, all the way through Ben's life. I mean, he just never relaxed. I don't think I thought anything at all about his choice. I just assumed that was what he was going to do. Did we ever consider leaving and going into just private practice? Ben would not have been happy doing that. When he was, after he'd retired and I just remember sitting out here at the kitchen table one day after lunch, and he said, you know, I'm very glad I lived my life the way I lived it. And if we could all do that, wouldn't it be absolutely wonderful? So I think he was very, very happy with how he had chosen. Didn't make all the money that, you know, his residents were making three times what he made. Mm-hmm. And I asked him once if that bothered him, and he said, no, I'm very pleased with them. They're doing a great job and good for them and stuff. So did he ever consider going to another university? Not seriously. He really, there were some bad times here, particularly after John Bowers was fired, when the whole medical school was pretty torn up. And at that time, Ben had only been here, I think, 4 years or 5 years, something like that. He was just beginning to get the department set up the way he wanted it, and he was recruiting and that sort of thing. And He his attitude was, my family's happy here, I'm happy here, this is my school, and I'm going to stay here. Following Dr. Gardner at Northwestern, that was certainly in Dr. Gardner's game plan early on in Ben's residency. He saw someone who was academically inclined and a pretty well-rounded fellow. And there was some thought of that. When we came up here, why, we felt we were coming for 5 years, and then we'd go back to Northwestern.
Oh, really?
But the 5 years came and went, and I can't remember when Dr. Gardner retired, but they picked absolutely the right person at Northwestern. Ben would not have been happy in that situation. There was a tremendous amount of fundraising, and the man that took that job, John Shira, was absolutely perfect for the job. He was willing to go around through the Chicago wealthy folks and sell his program, and they built a beautiful obstetrical hospital and the Prentice building and so forth, and John Shira did it, has done a great job. I don't know whether he's still there, but anyway.
A question. Had you sort of, for yourself, secretly wished to go back to Chicago in view of your long ties there?
I never wanted to go back to Chicago.
No.
I spent some time wondering what it would be like to go back. I knew one thing, and that was that I was never going to go and live in a suburb. That if we went back, that we were going to go and live where I had grown up, which was on the near north side. That this commuting is just murder. And I knew that much about it. And somehow or another, well, I think my parents had moved by that time and had gone to Arizona to live. And I just, I didn't have my old friends had gone, you know, they were scattered uh-huh. around, and there didn't seem to be any great pull.
Okay.
The condition of the OBGYN department when Ben arrived, it's pretty well spelled out in the, excuse me just a second while I look.
You ready?
Mm-hmm. When we came up here in 1956, Ben came up as professor and chairman of OBGYN, but the department was not a freestanding department. It was part of the Department of Surgery.
Oh.
And he was amazed to find that out after he got here. And one of the first things I think he did was to push to get his department separated from the Department of Surgery. There were only three full-time people in the faculty in the department, Dr. Ralph Campbell and Dr. Madeline Thornton and I think Dr. Bill Keekover had just, Bill was young and I don't think he'd been a faculty member for very many years, very few in fact. So it was mainly Dr. Campbell and Dr. Thornton. Dr. Campbell and Thornton, I think, were both trained at Johns Hopkins. And at Hopkins, you were either an obstetrician or you were a gynecologist. Dr. Thornton was an obstetrician. And her patients adored her. She sat there with them while they were in labor, sat at their bedside, paid a lot of attention to them, but really didn't have the skills to do forceps or bring the labor to a conclusion. Very sweet, lovely lady. Patients adored her. Had a great following here. Dr. Campbell didn't know how to do, well, of course, nobody knew how to do a vaginal hysterectomy. I think there was one person in Madison that had ever had any experience doing a vaginal hysterectomy. So this was, you know, and this was not a new procedure. This was something that had been going on in Chicago for many years, and Ben was well-trained in it, and everybody else that went to Northwestern was well-trained with it, and the University of Chicago. So here, this was sort of the first thing he did. So a lot of what Ben did those first years, the first thing he did when they concluded that the arrangements that we were coming up here, was to call Sam Pearlson. And Sam was at that time the senior resident. He was a fellow from Milwaukee. And he called Sam and said, "Sam, go home. We're going to cancel the part of the residency where you had to go to Chicago and work at lying in for 6 months or a year or something or other." And so Ben spent a lot of time acting as the chief resident. He was teaching his residents how to do various techniques, and he was the first assistant. So he sort of shouldered them through through the procedures until they all got very good at it themselves. So,
boy, that strikes me as different, perhaps. That must have caused some attention that he was doing that.
Well, I think it caused a lot of attention. The Department of Surgery sent one of their senior members to watch him operate to make sure that he knew how. And I think Ben thought it was kind of funny. And that man, I can't remember his name, but they became pretty good friends. He used to bring us perch from Lake Mendota. I'd never seen a perch before in my life. I didn't know what to do with these little things. But anyway, the department gradually, it took a tremendous amount of effort, and Ben's ulcer was bleeding, and those first months here, and we had no kitchen. We had bought an old house, beautiful, beautiful old house in Shortwood on almost an acre of land, and we'd paid $32,000 for it. And Ovid Meyer, who was chairman of surgery, said, "Ben, that was a terrible thing to do, just a terrible thing to do." But we did it, and we gutted the kitchen, and because the kitchen was really pretty old. The whole place was old. The house had been virtually a campground for 7 years. The lady of the house had died, and her clothes were still hanging in the closet. And
oh, wow.
It was in pretty rough shape. Not only that, but it was full of bugs. Oh, every kind of creepy crawly thing. Squirrels in the attic, bats all over the place. It was something. And the kitchen remodeling went on for 3 months. Well, I had a three-year-old. The two older children were a little easier to handle, but the three-year-old, I called my neighbor and I'd say to her, "Jane, we have no water today. May I bring Gardner over?" Because, you know, it was terrible. It was crazy. And Ben's ulcer was bleeding, so he wasn't well, and he was really fraught with trying to get all these things done at the hospital and so forth. But, you know, gradually it grew. And he continued to do research. And he had a young secretary. I've forgotten her name now. But she went off on a Sunday and went boating on Lake Mendota, and she fell into the water and drowned. And it was days and days before they found her. And that was a memorable time. The family, her family was just frantic, and it was awful. So those first years were difficult. Gradually, I can't remember in what order the staff was added to. I remember Dee Beekler came up from, I think she'd been in Kansas, and she was a gynecologic oncologist. Sander Shapiro came. He was in vitro fertilization.
Oh.
And it was kind of slow going because there weren't very many patients. You look at the hospital as it is today, University Hospital, you can hardly find a place to park in the big ramps. In the old hospital, there wasn't any ramp. There was very little parking, and there were very few patients.
Why? Because of the parking?
I think it was a whole combination of things. For one thing, the patients were not encouraged to go back to their home physician if they went after they came down here. You'd come down from up north someplace, and some doctor would say to you, "Now you must come back here for all your care. Don't go back to old Charlie up there in your hometown." And Ben went around the state with Roy Raggetts, who was at that time with the State Medical Society, in what might be considered outreach talks and education and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And he made trips around the state with Roy Raggetts giving talks about gynecology, obstetrics, and telling the local doctors that if they were having trouble with a patient, send them down, he'd see them, and he'd send them back to them. And he'd tell the doctor what he was doing, and the patient would go back informed with what had happened to her while she was here. So this sort of made, you know, the local physicians in the smaller communities more inclined to send their patients down if they thought they were going to get them back.
So at this time, the UW Hospital had its own OB unit.
Yes.
Dan wasn't working over at Madison General or St. Mary's.
The old hospital, I think they moved into the new hospital. See, we came in 56. They didn't move into the new hospital until 77 or 8, something like that.
Right.
It was quite some time. And they had a very small, but they closed the OB unit before that time.
Oh.
But they had a very small unit at University Hospital. Patients loved it. It was private care. They had nurses and, you know, but they did not have all the equipment that the big birthing centers had. Now, that was nothing compared to what they have now, but there wasn't, you know, to buy ultrasound and all that sort of thing was very costly. Mm-hmm. And for a handful of patients, it was really not cost effective, excuse me. And at that time, I can't remember who the president was. In my memory, it seems to have been Eisenhower, but I can't remember who it was. But they were encouraging communities to share that expensive equipment rather than to have each hospital have its own. And so with considerable consultation and so forth and so on, it went on for some long time, they merged the department at Meritor Hospital, which was then Madison General, with the OB with the university, closed the university unit. And made all of the faculty who had boards, they had to be boarded, they'd had to pass their American boards in obstetrics and gynecology in order to qualify, but they made them all associate professors. And that worked very well, except at St. Mary's. And at St. Mary's, those were dark days. The woman that was running the hospital was Sister Rebecca. And Sister Rebecca was a lovely nun, and she was difficult to work with. She didn't always come through as she had suggested she would. And so gradually, and they of course would not allow patients to have their tubes tied at St. Mary's Hospital, and so it became obvious that they were going to have their own intensive care nursery. By that time, everybody was thinking about intensive care nurseries and all the very, very expensive equipment that's in those places. So there was one developed at Meritor, or Madison General, it was then, and one at St. Mary's. And you ask here something about politics. How quickly did Ben become involved in medical school politics? It was almost the day he walked in the door. In the first place, the dean, John Bowers, who had brought Ben to Madison, was under siege from the very beginning. He had antagonized all the old faculty. He wanted to, maybe not all of it, but most of it, certainly the whole Department of Surgery was opposed to him because he wanted to bring in an outsider to update the Department of Surgery. And they wanted their old friend, Tony Carreri, who had been trained here in La-di-da, he's one of the boys, and they wanted Tony. And so this was a mess, and John Bowers brought in five department chairmen. He brought in a pediatrician, a radiologist, a psychiatrist, an OBGYN, and a neurologist, Frank Forrester. Frank Forrester was a very distinguished neurologist. And after a while, the whole situation in the medical school became such an unhappy situation. People fighting with their old friends, and it was terrible. That the Board of Regents, there was a committee that went to Conrad Elvium, the president of the university, and said, "You've got to get rid of this man." And the Board of Regents decided, yes, they needed to get rid of this man. So
that was a Board of Regents initiative to let John Bowers go.
Well, with a lot of pressure, but they could see that there was such turmoil in the medical school, and they were just trying to calm things down. Mm-hmm. John had been brought here. He had been charged with changing the way the medical school, bringing the medical school into the 20th century. It was an old guard institution. They didn't want to change their ways. They loved the old hospital building, and they didn't, modern things, forget it. They weren't interested in that. They knew what they were doing, and they'd been reasonably successful, and if some of those people could see what's going on at the university hospital right now, they'd be aghast. But you could see you could see why the regents did what they did, because they were just trying to throw oil on the burning water. We met Charles Gillette, who was on the Board of Regents at that time, out at the airport the very afternoon that the regents did this. And Ben was really upset. We were out of the airport to meet a gynecologist from the University of Michigan who was coming over to spend a few days with the residents and as a, you know, outside information educational source. And Charles, I don't think he was glad to see us, and Ben was certainly not glad to see him. It was really kind of an awful day. But gradually things got better. Where are we now?
Well, let's see.
Oh, he got involved in the politics and the personnel struggles very, very quickly. And the personnel struggles with St. Mary's Hospital went on for some long time. After the new hospital was built and so forth, there was always a little friction there.
And you said that John Bowers brought in 5 new department chairs. When he was fired, did many of those folks leave?
I think some of them left right away, as I recall. I mean, they said, all right, no Bowers, no me. I think there were 3 that left. Frank Forrester and Ben stayed on. And as I said, I'll repeat, Ben kept saying, this is my school. I'm going to stay here. My family's happy here. And I want to continue with what I'm doing in the department. And Frank stayed for a long time, and that was a very distinguished department when he was here. So I can't remember who the next dean was, but there were 9 deans that came after John Bowers.
Oh, really?
In fairly quick succession. John himself used to say, you know, deans don't last very long. They, instead of having bound books, they have 3-ring notebooks. So.
And I'm curious, did Ben stay in touch with John Bowers after he left?
Not much. And the Bowers' children were sort of matched our children's ages. And we had gone on picnics and we were friends. And the kids, I don't know whether the kids really liked one another very well, but at least, you know, to go off with the families, they were there. And Imogen and I were in and out of one of those houses, like lots of women are, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I stopped by the house after this, and she wouldn't let me in the door after Ben had decided he was going to stay. She was very, very bitter. And she was taking some courses in social work, I think, at the university by that time. And I think she went to Michigan. John went back to New York. I think he went back to the Rockefeller Institute. Oh. Ben met him down in at an OBGYN meeting down in Virginia several years later, and he asked Ben to do him a favor, which was pretty typical of John. I don't know what it was. Ben did it, and that was the end of John. And he thought Ben should have resigned. He thought everybody should, you know. So it was those are very hurtful things that happen. How much of Ben's time went to his medical practice as opposed to his administrative responsibilities as chair? Well, he was allowed to double his salary, which was $13,000. And he was allowed to double that in private practice. And I don't think he did that for some long time.
He got paid at the double rate when he was engaged in practice, or?
No. He got what the patients paid him, up to $13,000.
Oh, I see.
He could double. He could get $26,000 a year.
I see.
But I don't think that happened for a long time. In the first place, he charged more than the town doctors. He did not want to be in competition with the town doctors. And so he charged more. And I have a friend that said that her doctor had recommended that she go to Ben. And when she asked him how much he would charge for her delivery, she said she couldn't afford to pay it. She has an awful lot of money. I don't know what was the matter with her. But anyway, that was all right. So it took a while for his practice to build up. And it was... I think he took very good care of his patients. I think they liked him. I still have women come up to me and say, I've never found anybody since that I liked as well. But he was pretty centered on academic medicine, and he was very, very involved. Dr. Gardner had started taking Ben to national meetings, and I don't mean the... the big meetings where everybody could come. These were small groups. Gynecologic investigation. Ben was one of the founders of the Society for Gynecologic Investigation. And these were the professors in the university. These were the academicians.
Uh-huh.
And Dr. Gardner started taking Ben to these when he was still in residency, or very shortly afterward. And so he sort of got his foot in the door at an early age. And because he was so focused on academic medicine, why, these groups were interested in him too. So he ended up belonging in this he served as president of the American Gynecological Society. Now that has 100 members, and it's a very, very old group. President of the Association of Professors of Gynecology and Obstetrics, and president of the Society for Gynecologic Investigation, president of the American Gynae Club, which had 50 members, affiliated with Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin for a very long time. We can go into that in another minute. But you asked, did he always see a woman through her delivery? I think he tried, certainly at the beginning. We never went away. If we had a picnic, we had it in the backyard. He was on call 24/7, and...
Really?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And then after they started sharing, he and Bill Kekover and I think Lee Kennan had come by that time. I can't really remember it back that far, but we didn't take big vacations and things like that.
And I'm curious from a cultural point of view, did you and the kids resent that, or was that just the way it was?
This is the way it was.
Uh-huh. I mean, you didn't really...
Did I wish he was home? You betcha. Mm-hmm. Particularly when one of the kids was sick or something. It would have been really nice to have a helping hand. But that was the way it was, and... You adjust. You know, there are plenty of doctors' wives that go through this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And probably other than doctors' wives also. Did he have patients from across the state? Indeed, he did have patients from across the state. But they were not, they came and were taken care of and went back where they came from. And I think they came to see him fairly often and so forth. I really don't know. You know, I wasn't there.
And another question. You all came here in 56. How long did it take before Dr. Ben Peckham was a known figure in the state? Because he certainly was. People would know of Dr. Peckham.
Well, I think part of it was his travels with Roy Raggetts helped a lot. The patients that came to him liked him and took his name home. But when his residents started graduating and went out, see, most of them stayed in the state. The first ones stayed in Madison because there was a definite void here in skilled gynecologists. And so they were snapped up by some of the groups here or were on their own. And then they started going around the state. And, they went to Marshfield and Milwaukee. I don't know how many of them were over in Milwaukee or Waukesha and mm-hmm. so forth. And so they certainly took the name around. I really don't know, Bob, how long it took or how he was known around the state, that's for sure. I was doing a lot of traveling around the state at the same time.
Is this when you're working for the Republican Party?
Right. I started going around the state in 1968. Oh. And I went to a lot of the counties, so I really, these are hard questions to answer. He was lecturing in the medical school, indeed, he was. He got awards from the medical students. They liked him. He used to talk about his practice in Chicago, where he had they were the Adorables, a bunch of women that went around with very little on, in a nightclub that was near Wesley Hospital, and these women, and he said, they're just like every other woman. They have husbands, they have children. They have lovely bodies that they show off, but he'd entertain, he'd make up stories about them to keep the medical students interested.
And when he was lecturing, I don't know about the curriculum in the medical school, was he lecturing like to first-year students as an intro to OBGYN, or did he work with the older, the third and fourth-year students?
I don't know. My guess is that he did some of both. Mm. But I don't know how the curriculum, it's all changed, but he certainly did. He did lecture. And he also did a lot of teaching with the interns and the residents, particularly the residents. And he had a ground rounds on Saturday morning at 7 o'clock, which they all just hated.
Sure.
I don't know what his research interests were in those days. They became more clinical as time went on because he didn't have time to keep a lab going. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not just sure what he was. I know when we went on a tour to China with people to people, there were 20 or 25 doctors that went on this trip. They were all in obstetrics and gynecology.
Oh.
And five of them were chosen to speak at the various meetings. And Ben had done, I can't remember what it was, but it was some special thing that was of great interest to the Chinese. And so he was chosen and to give his paper. And he had an interpreter, of course. And he found that absolutely fascinating. The interpreter, he said the interpreter could have given the talk without him. But it was a great experience.
When was that, Anne?
That was 1984.
Okay.
The next year, we went with People to People to New Zealand and Australia. And that was far less... Well, it was great. I mean, it was wonderful to see the country, and we had very good friends in Australia that we enjoyed being with. And we went to the reef and snorkeled and had a great time in Australia. The New Zealanders were very upset. Greenpeace had a ship in the harbor, and they were very upset about our nuclear submarines. And we got in the elevator at a hotel one day, and we were talking. There were four of us or so, and we were talking to one another, so we were talking our own language. And this man turned around, and he said, "Oh, Americans," he said, "you're brave to be here." We thought, really? The dean of the one of the medical schools said to me, he said, "America, the United States isn't going to last." He said, "They'll go down. They think they can take care of everybody, but they'll go down. Their time will come." And I said, "You know, there are a lot of us that are a little tired of taking care of the rest of the world, and we just soon have a little help." He didn't think that was very nice. So New Zealand was kind of amazing. It's a wonderful place, but anyway, about his research, I really am not, you know, so much of this was done outside of my vision. Did he ever aspire to being dean? Well, he was associate dean for, I don't know how many years. It was five or something, 67 to 71. And that took a lot of time. All of these committees and these boards, he was an examiner for the American boards, and those things all took time. So it was a balancing act of getting all those things done and keeping his practice and keeping his department. And
as associate dean, Anne, was he very involved in the hiring of new physicians to come here?
I think he was on some committees, yeah. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I really don't know. He didn't bring most of that home. You want to know how his involvement in Planned Parenthood happened? He was scratching for patients. You know, you don't learn gynecology on plastic figures. You are out of textbooks. You have to have people, mm-hmm. women, and Planned Parenthood was very happy to have a physician that wanted to offer their assistants and their residents to come into the clinics. Oh. And so that was a wonderful association. And the residents all went to the Madison Planned Parenthood Clinic. I don't know how many days a week they took turns, I'm sure, because they all had, you know, things to do. But that was a lasting thing. And then they made him the medical advisor, and then he went on the state board as medical advisor. And he was very, very supportive of Planned Parenthood. I think you'd be thrilled to see this new clinic that's just opened down on the south side of Madison. This is a very nice facility. I never did become involved with Planned Parenthood until recently.
Oh, that's a recent development.
Yes, and I'm not involved with them much now. I tried to help them raise money to build the clinic on the east side. I don't think I was very successful. Then they've honored Ben, and he's on a plaque with B. Kabler down at the new clinic on the south side.
Yes. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, it's very, very nice. I'm sure he'd be delighted to be on a plaque with B. Kabler. And I was with NARAL and the National Abortion Rights Action League, it was called at that time. And there were two Republicans on that 32-person board.
Was so that a state board or
a national board? A woman in Milwaukee, I'm ashamed to say I don't remember her name, but she was on the board and she suggested me because I was pro-choice and I was a Republican. Mm-hmm. And a reasonably high-profile Republican.
And because of your work for the party?
For the party, mm-hmm. Absolutely. The party was not as hard-lined as it is now. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed this. It was very interesting. It was a constant fight. They put me on the board. Well, they made me secretary, for one thing. Somebody else wrote the minutes. All I did was rubber stamp them because they wanted them to read the way they wanted them to read. And they put me on the PAC board, the Political Action Committee, where it was a constant struggle. Chuck Percy in Illinois was the governor at that time.
Oh, yes.
And he was very pro-choice. And I tried to get them to support him. No, they didn't. No way. They never gave a dime to a Republican. Except
even a pro-choice one, and Percy was prominent, wasn't he?
Oh yeah, he was a governor, and you know, better than Blagojevich, quite a long shot. I think he had a lot of money, so I think he was probably pretty honest. The man from Oregon, the senator from Oregon, now his name slips me right now too. They were very high on him.
Packwood.
And Packwood got ousted because he patted fannies or something of the staff in Washington. So, So he didn't. But oh, they thought he was just wonderful. But any other Republican, boy, they were not interested in him at all. And they were very nice to me. The board was. And I had an interesting time. It was back and forth to Washington about six times a year.
Oh.
And it became, and Ben was, he had constant heart problems, sometimes more than others. And it became obvious to me that when I was going to be out of town, he didn't feel well. And so I thought, this is dumb. I don't need this. I've done it. I've seen it. I know what it is now, and I don't need it anymore. So I got off the board.
And was Ben supportive of your being on NARAL?
Oh sure, mm-hmm. Oh sure. No, he had opened in 1973. As soon as Roe v. Wade was passed, he opened a clinic at University Hospital, an abortion clinic.
Oh.
Right in the hospital.
Huh. That would be in the old hospital.
No, it was in the new one.
In 73?
Would have been in the old hospital. You're right.
Okay.
That's right. I don't know where it was that time. But I know they had it in the new hospital, too, because they were parading around out the anti... People were parading around outside the hospital and so forth. It's a tough issue. I look at what's going on in Washington right now, and I have such mixed emotions about it myself. And I see that it's not settled by a long shot. Heaven forbid that they would overturn Roe v. Wade. But it's still a tough issue.
I take it that you and or Ben did not suffer consequences, social or political, because you were pro-choice.
Oh, I did. I did. Ben went down. He and me, Cabler, were such good friends. They were not trying. It was not the abortion issue. It was the indecent article. A contraceptive was an indecent article in our statutes here in Wisconsin. And Ben spent a lot of time talking to legislators about this. And not a lot of time. Betty Smith, bless her heart, wrote some memoirs, and it sounded in the chapter that they gave me to check out as if Ben was living down in the Capitol talking to the legislators. That was not the case. I know that. But I do know that he was down there, and that he established a relationship with some of the legislators on that particular issue. What was the question you asked me?
Were there social or political
consequences? Oh, for me, yeah. Not social, but political issues for me. And because I went to... I always went to the county caucuses. I always went to the district caucuses. I went to the state conventions. And I got up at a district caucus and said, you know, you enact this resolution, and you're going to lose an awful lot of voters if you have such a strident approach to the abortion issue. And my fellow Dane County delegates lined up on the wall and booed me. And I walked out of that convention, and I've never been to one since. I thought, if that's the way it's going to be, I'm out of here. So I'm still a Republican. I pay my dues to the county. I feel like a Republican, but I'm hoping that the day is going to come when the abortion issue is not so high profile in the party. I mean, it's restrictive, and they've lost a heck of a lot of members. Did Ben travel the state much? I think we pretty much covered that. He did. Yes. He did. If he was invited, he went, and he did a lot of national work. Question number 9.
Maybe centers of power is the wrong way.
Yeah, I think.
But the reason I ask it is that Peckham was well known, and I'm talking about Ben and Ann. And so I'm just interested in what it was like to be prominent in the medical community.
I wouldn't have any idea. I think Ben, I didn't go to a lot of the state meetings with him. I did go to some. There were people that didn't like him, you know, who resented him and so forth. I don't know. I really don't have any answer to that. Did we do a lot of entertaining of other physicians and their spouses? Yes, indeed we did. We had the department parties at our house. for years and years and years, you know. I don't know how many other departments had parties, but it was thought that this was a good thing to do, that when the residents graduated and the new residents were coming in, we would have a party at our house. And it became a pig roast.
Oh.
Somebody suggested these two men who had worked at Oscar Mayer, and they had an oil drum, and they'd fitted the oil drum out as a roaster. And they would come to our house and set up the roaster in the driveway the night before the party, and they'd get the fire started. And then the next morning, they'd bring the pig that was their wives had put the stuffing in. And they would cook this pig for hours and hours. And we had a couple of residents that culturally they thought this was just so wonderful. Well, one was became staff, and that was Ben Curat. They were from Puerto Rico. And then we had Antonio Colas. He was Spanish.
Oh.
And he was a specialist. He was in two departments. He was a researcher. And so they kind of knew the ropes on this pig business, particularly Ben Curat. And he would come and make sure that we got the most tender, best parts of the pig to put in our freezer.
Oh, before the residents.
And then he got the cheeks. Oh, gosh, it was really great. We had a lot of fun, and the staff wives would bring part of the dinner and salads and stuff. And we had a lot of fun.
So that would be, I assume, in the end of June.
Yes, get a keg of beer, and everybody had a good time. I think it was the more formal parties. Whenever we had a visitor that came to spend a few days talking to the department, as Ben did with a lot of other departments around the country. We always had a party for them.
Uh-huh.
And finally, the department was getting bigger and more successful. And I asked Coretta if it would be possible. Coretta was the department administrator. She held the purse strings. I said, would it be possible for me to get some help? And she said, of course. So I got a couple of women that would come in, and they would help just move I'd cook the dinner, but they'd kind of move things around and make drinks. And
oh.
And I had a couple of medical school wives. They were wonderful. They enjoyed the parties hugely. So that was nice. And then finally I said, look, this is getting overly much. And so I had a caterer. And never brought the whole dinner in or anything, but I had a woman that came in, and she was a wonderful cook, and she cooked the whole dinner, and she brought a helper with her. And so it became less of a burden. Now, enough members of the department belong to clubs, which we did not. We belonged to the Madison Club for 1 year, and the kids hated it because they had to get dressed up to go there, so... That didn't last very long, but now they do all the entertaining in clubs. I think it has lost something.
And that's where I was headed, because I have talked to other older faculty from a variety of disciplines and departments who said there used to be entertaining, significantly social, that complemented the professional work, and that they thought things have gone downhill since that ended.
Yeah. Well, partly because everybody's getting older, and to put on a dinner party it's an effort, mm-hmm. considerable effort, if you're having a whole lot of people. And I'm not talking about 50 or anything, but, you know, to feed 20 people, that's a lot. I'm not about to do such a thing mm-hmm. anymore, but I surely did do it. And I, as far as the residents were concerned, I think it was very important for them to see where their boss lived and how he lived and what his family looked like. And I thought that was very important. It was interesting. You learned a lot about the residents. They received an invitation to come to our house. Mm-hmm. And some of them never bothered to respond. Coretta had to follow up and find out whether they were coming or not. But always, big old Bill Kohler, who used to have shaggy hair and wear cloppy Dutch kind of shoes. What do you call those?
Those wooden shoes?
Old man, alive man, used to get so upset with him. He didn't look like a well-groomed doctor should. Karen Kohler always wrote me a thank you note. She was a star. And you learn, and yet here's Bill, he's a shaggy old guy. And you learned a lot about these kids, whether they came up at the end of the party and thanked you. And I think it was very good for them.
Uh-huh.
Some of them needed a little polishing.
Uh-huh.
A man came into the department from a big drug company in New Jersey. Ken Thompson. And Ken came from a big drug company where they said at 70 or 65, you need to retire. And he didn't want to retire. So he came out here as, I can't remember exactly what his title was, but he worked with the residents and he worked in research. And he took it upon himself to polish the residents.
Was he a physician or?
He had been a physician, but he was became a researcher. He didn't practice clinical medicine. They were a delightful couple. They were big supporters of the symphony, and they would take anyone who was interested, any of the residents, to the symphony and give them that experience. And Ken was big on this sort of thing. And I think that enriched the department. I don't think they all thought that was such a grand idea, but some of them certainly picked it up. Ben Curet and Ben and Lydia, I'm sure they're down in Albuquerque, and I'm sure they go to the symphony down there. And, you know, it was very, very, it was helpful, I thought. The family. It's hard to, we had three children. The first two were 2 years apart, and the third one was 4 years younger than his brother. And Ben really, when the first two were babies, Ben was really home so little. He was a resident, and at that time, you got home one night, 1 week, two nights the next, and three nights the third. So when he came home, he was so tired that I would have the kids in their pajamas, and they would say hello to Daddy, and that was the end. And he kind of missed an awful lot with those first two. The younger one was born when we moved to Evanston, shortly after we moved to Evanston. Ben was in practice by that time. His life was a little less hectic, in spite of the fact that he had a 30-minute ride in and out of town at least twice a day. And so he saw, you know, he really attached to this third child. And I think the older two felt kind of left out part of the time. I don't think Ben recognized that. I mean, I think he was he was very interested. He's terribly proud of the way they've grown up. We were in a horrendous automobile accident at Christmas time when Roger was 2 years old. And he was in a little booster seat in the back of the car. We'd borrowed my father's car to go out to Glenview to my old best friend and her husband and their children. They were the godparents of our children, and for a little Christmas celebration, and we were hit. The side of the car was hit, the back, sort of the side in the back, and it spun the little car seat across the car, and Roger's head hit the window in the back. Those seats were never meant for safety. They were meant so the child could look out the window. And he was unconscious right away, and they opened his head that night, and because the dura had been torn and he had fluid on his brain, and it was as if he'd had a stroke. The whole side of his body was just limp, and his eye was closed. And he was two and something. That was Christmas. He was an August baby. He was very verbal. He could recite all kinds of things, and he was a chatty little guy. And he lost the speech center in his brain, so he had to learn to talk over again. But at two, he sort of dealt with all these things. He was a very happy child, but it was very painful. I mean, after all, Ben had been driving the car. This was not his fault. But at the same time, he had been driving the car, and so he felt responsible. And I think it was very hard all through the rest of Ben's life to see this young man who had lost the vision in one eye. And that was the residual damage. He got all the fine movements in his hands and everything back. He plays tennis, he skis, he's an endocrinologist. He was a very fine student, but he can't see out of one eye. And there are a lot of people, we don't realize how many people there are that go through life with one eye. Mm-hmm. I think he's adapted well as he gets older. I worry considerably, and I always have, that he sort of took for granted that his other eye was always going to be perfect. And if he was ever going to get hit with something in gym class at school or something, it was always in the good eye. And I think now that he's older, he realizes he compensates more than, it was just sort of part of life as a youngster. But the children, so Rogers had a hard time. And when each of the children bought a house, Ben not only enjoyed making jewelry, but he was a great Mr. Fix-It in the house. Oh. He always had a workbench, he always had saws, he always had had equipment to fix things and to make things. He enjoyed that a great deal. And when the kids each bought a house, we went to visit, and he took them to the lumber yard, and they got all the lumber and all the tools necessary to build a workbench. And we stayed there while they built the son or daughter. And Ben built the workbench and got it all set up. And Roger had some kind of a class in high school where they made things. Uh-huh. And he said he was always terrified of the electric saws. And, of course, the people that worked with him, that dealt with him, his teachers, they didn't know that he could only see out of one eye, so he had no depth perception. So a whirling saw was a pretty frightening thing for a kid. Mm-hmm. And Ben spent a lot of time when Roger bought his first house helping him learn how to arrange whatever he wanted to saw so he didn't have his hands in the way of this swirling saw blade. And Raj mentioned that. He said, I was always scared to death in shop class in school. So I think he had a hard time. I think toward the end of Ben's life, when he'd retired and he had more time, he really got very close to all of the children. Mary, who was the oldest one, and married a surgeon, and they live in Ann Arbor, and she got into the dog world.
But she's a nurse, right?
She's a nurse. She met her husband when she was nursing at Yale. She went to Presbyterian St. Luke's training. Then she went to Yale. She wanted to be near New York. That seemed such a magnet city. And she met Richard. He was a resident, surgical resident. He was trained by the surgeon that John Bauer selected to come to Wisconsin, who, when the fur began to fly, quit and went to Yale instead. What goes around comes around. And they settled, after Richard was in the Army for a couple of years, why they settled in Ann Arbor. And Mary started raising dogs. And she is still. And Ben was extremely impressed with how much Mary knew about dogs and how much she knew about breeding dogs. She's a very careful breeder. There's none of this, oh, well, that looks like a nice dog, let's have him. And she now has 10 dogs in her kennel, which is attached to her house. She has a couple of champions. She's had, one of them died, but she's had a couple of champions. She's into, what's it called, where they jump through hoops and they do all that sort of thing. She now has 10 adults and 5 puppies that are now about 10 days old. And this is very much her life. They're on 22 acres on the edge of Ann Arbor. And she is very involved in the dog club and so forth. And her father was very impressed with her dedication to, she doesn't just have dogs, she really knows dogs. Mm-hmm. She teaches in the dog training club and been the president of the training club for 4 years or something. And, you know, she's very active, very hard worker. All the children got that work ethic from their father. They're very hard workers. The third one, who was definitely father's adored baby, he's in Washington. I think to this very day, Ben's been gone 15 years now, I think to this very day, Gardner misses him a great deal. He is interested in so many of the things that Ben was interested in, like fishing and guns. Ben used to take the children, all three of them, out to the Middleton Gun Club to shoot clay birds and things like that. He wanted them to know guns and how to handle them. And we had guns in the house. They were in a case, but the case was not locked. And there was, you know, in retrospect, when I read about what goes on sometimes, why I wonder why we did that. But the kids respected the guns. They enjoyed going out and shooting them. And they didn't sit around the house playing with them, that was for sure. And the fishing, Gardner is just really devoted to fishing. He's a fly fisherman. Catch and release. He's now making split bamboo fly rods. He went up to some fellow in New Jersey and learned how, went weekends to learn how to make these things. He has now his own equipment. He ties all his flies, and He went down there to graduate school. I thought we'd never get him through high school. He went to West High. The two older children had gone to Central, where there was a lot more discipline than there was at West High. And when Gardner came along, his Shorewood children were funneled into West High instead of Central. And I just had the feeling that Gardner was not in trouble. He was not a great student, and he just sort of passed through the school. In fact, I told the senior advisor, who had been a civics professor, I believe, at Central and had known the two older children, I said to him, "Mr. Colucci, this boy could get killed out here on the street. I don't think there's anybody in this school who would be able to identify his body. I just have a feeling he's just passing through here." And Mr. Colucci was not very happy to hear that, but that was the way I felt about that school. Gardner was accepted at Ohio Wesleyan. They needed students at that particular time. One of our neighbor's sons was there and said, "Hey, you know, they're looking for students." And Gardner applied and was accepted. It was the best thing that ever happened to him. He graduated in political science and in history. He had a political science teacher who helped to write the platform for the Republican Party. Behind the scenes, kind of, you know.
For thing. Which year would that be?
Gardner graduated in 71. So it was those late 60s and so forth. For all I know, he did it a lot longer after that, too. I'm not sure. But anyway, he'd have the kids come to his house and they'd talk politics. And so Gardner decided he wanted to go to American University and get his master's in politics. So he went to American. He got all the work done. He didn't write his thesis. He lived in a boarding house. And the fellow that the other boarder was a young man whose father had been a congressman from California. And John was at Georgetown. And he was graduating and going to law school in California. And he was working for a man by the name of Goodloe Byron, who was a congressman from New York. And he said, "You don't need to pay him. He'll just come and work." So that was Gardner's entree into congressional staffing. Mr. Byron dropped dead jogging around the reservoir in New York. And so then Gardner went to work he went to see if Mr. Kastenmeyer, who was our congressman, would take him in. Kastenmeyer had nothing to say to him except, "Why didn't you go to the University of Wisconsin?" So that was that. So he went to work for a man who had been a teacher in a district in Pennsylvania. And I ought to remember his name. He's such a nice man. And he was in the district where the atomic, what was that thing called? When it blew.
Three Mile Island
was in that district. So Gardner spent a lot of time. He was being paid by that time. Not much, but he was being paid. And he spent a lot of time answering letters about Three Mile Island because this poor gentleman got all kinds of heat on that. But he put Gardner on the Africa Subcommittee staff. He was on the Africa Subcommittee himself, and they needed a Republican staffer. Uh-huh. So Gardner spent 6 years as a Republican staffer with, there were 9 Democrat staffers on that committee. But every time a congressman wanted to go to Africa, they had to take staff from both sides of the aisle. Oh. Well, there was only one Republican, so Gardner had some marvelous trips to Africa, many, many of them. And for 6 years, he became imbued in African politics. And his older daughter, the mother, Terry, had her PhD in early childhood development. And she said to Gardner, you know, when you're holding her, you need to talk to her. So what he did was recite the countries in Africa and their capitals. So embedded in Elizabeth's brain is all this stuff about Africa. But it was a great experience. And he went on from there, staffing committees. He was on the Foreign Affairs Committee. He went to the State Department for a couple of years during the first Bush administration. Some woman in the White House had in the National Security, working for General Scowcroft, had a baby, and Gardner went to the White House for a few months while she was on leave. And he ended up, he worked with Henry Hyde on the Republican Policy Committee. And then in 1994, no. What year was that? Yes, it was 94 when the Congress changed and Newt Gingrich became the Speaker of the House. And he was looking for staff. And by this time, Gardner's wife had this terrible cancer in her head, and two little children, and we were all terribly concerned that Terry was not going to live. And she was having such a lot of chemo and a lot of radiation and terrible surgery and so forth, and Gardner was distracted, to say the least, so he wasn't really spending a lot of time trying to find himself a job, because Henry Hyde had decided he would go to the Judiciary Committee, and Gardner is not a lawyer, so he didn't want to go to the Judiciary Committee, though Congressman Hyde was very, very kind to Gardner. But anyway, Gardner's friends got him a job with Newt Gingrich, and they had worked together on some things, so Gingrich knew Gardner some. And he hired him as his foreign affairs, trade, and national security person. He had four staff that were the top staff. Gardner was the only one that was on foreign and national security, which are still his strengths. He spent 4 years with Newt, and they were very, very, it was very, very interesting. I thought he was going to have withdrawal symptoms when he left the Congress, because he certainly had a lot of experience. And he's now with a consulting firm in Washington. This all starts out with his father, of course, and I think, you know, as I say to this day, I think he misses him a great deal.
And I have to ask you, your two older children had careers and still do, I suppose, in a way, in healthcare, and your youngest child was in politics, kind of, in a way, reflecting professional interests of you and Ben.
Right.
Did you and he ever talk about that much?
I don't know. The kids did what they wanted to do. They became, they're very independent. Mm-hmm. Roger is a doctor. He's an endocrinologist. Mm-hmm. I think he's very good at what he does. married to a radiologist. They have one child who's 14, and they aren't going to have any more. And you know, he's a wonderful man. Even his sister says, you know, Roger's a really nice man. Mary was a nurse. She gave up nursing when she and Richard wanted to have a baby, and they thought the stress, she was on a cancer floor at Yale, and they thought the stress was, it wasn't that at all. But anyway, she eventually had three children. So she takes care of her dogs. She can do a lot for those dogs that the average non-nurse would not probably want to do. She trims tails and dew claws and gives shots, and you know, she uses her medical knowledge on these dogs, which is good. You have one last question here. What was Ben like? What kind of physician was he? I don't know what kind of a physician he was. I think he was a pretty successful one. I think his patients liked him. I think his peers respected him. On April 30th, the new chairman of the department, Dr. Laurel Rice, is putting on a seminar for Ben with the money, I imagine, with the money that's in the alumni.
Oh, over at the foundation.
The Memorial Fund. Memorial Fund. And so we'll see. I don't know whether any of the residents will come back, but I think that the people that he trained had a lot of respect for him. Mm-hmm. By and large, they've done well. Mm-hmm. And Gloria Sarto in particular. You know, Gloria was his first woman resident.
Oh.
They had to clean out a closet to make a bed for her because there wasn't any sleeping accommodation in the hospital for a woman in that department.
Really?
So, and she went on to get her PhD in genetics. She worked with Jim Crow. And she was a co-chair of the department at Northwestern. And she came to Mount Sinai and was a co-chair there. She went down to Albuquerque and was chairman down there. And then came back up here, and she sort of has her own show as far as research is concerned. She's very concerned in the discrepancies between minority care and white care. And so I think as far as being a physician is concerned, he was as good as they come. What was he like? He was wonderful to live with. I could have killed him on many occasions, but he got up in the morning happy, and he looked forward to the day. And as his heart became more and more of a problem, I would look at him and wonder whether he was going to come home at night, because he looked so badly. And but he always, every day was a challenge, and he was really very, very nice to live with. I think he liked me. I think he appreciated what I did, and if I was any help to him, I think he appreciated that. I think he liked the way he lived at home. He was pleased with his children, and you know, he was a great guy.
This now concludes the March 15th, 2010 interview with Ann Peckham. Thank you so much, Ann.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.